on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
I've realised now that I'm probably not the only one that's happened to. I think the good thing about things like this is it's important to show that you're not alone if that's your situation. Yeah. And it's not a problem telling people. It's not a problem to talk about it.
Yeah,
I'm not ashamed to talk about the fact I struggle. I don't think anybody should be.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers. No more barriers. No one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome to The Self-Publishing Show with James.
And Mark.
How's your lockdown going, Dawson?
All right, thanks, Blatch. We're not dead, which is the main thing. Yes, yep. It's all right. As this is our second time of recording this podcast, because rural internet may not be playing ball with us today. So yes, it's going okay. And as we said last week's episode, we've had some lovely comments from listeners and viewers who enjoyed last week's episode. The basic message was everyone deals with this in the best way that they can. And some people like me are schooling kids, with Lucy and I looking after the two kids who go back to school today. So we're homeschooling them. Other people aren't in the right frame of mind to be able to write productively right now. So we just have to do as best we can. And, you know, from my perspective, it is still involving getting up at 6 and working till 8, taking the dog for a walk, and then basically being dad for the rest of the day. If I get any more time in to take, you know, to work, be that on writing or SPF or Hello Books or anything, then that's a bonus. But that's the best I can do at the moment. And, you know, there's no, can't really get around that.
It is a period of adjustment. And if you didn't hear last week's episode, definitely worth listening to, particularly if you are struggling to write at the moment and think that you're neglecting your day job. Mark came up with a few things that you can be doing to do with your backlist and other things that could make the most of this time, because there is definitely an uptick in reading and purchasing of online things, whatever they are, actually. And so there is something to be taken advantage of. But yes, we are a community, and you can post into the groups and get some tips and helps and maybe just a bit of sympathy for your particular situation if you're in our Facebook group. Okay, look, we've got a few things to do today. I want to kind of rattle through them just in case this rural internet gives up again. First of all, I want to welcome Peter M. Street from OR USA, which I guess must be Oregon.
Oregon.
Got to be, isn't it? Thank you very much indeed, Peter, for being a Patreon supporter. You too can get a name check on The Self-Publishing Show if you go to patreon.com/self-publishing show. Okay, we are also going to talk about our bestseller course. So in between last week and this week, we have launched it. It's kind of had a soft launch for a few days where we just basically put it out there. Ash is quite pleased because one of the early people did pick up, despite the fact it went through, I think, 20 beta readers. There are a couple of typos that we just picked up very early, and it's inevitable with 12 hours of video. It's
Christopher Wills. So thank you very much, Christopher. Yes, that was very helpful.
Christopher. So I went through this morning, just changed out a couple of things. But anyway, it's the early feedback is, I have to say, very, very good for this course. Susie's getting great plaudits. Susie Quinn is the best-selling author who's done How to Write a Bestseller. And I think people are really digging what the course does, which is to reverse the normal way of writing, where you write away in the dark and then you hawk your manuscript around and you hope that an agent and a publisher, it chimes with what they're particularly looking for. Bearing in mind, you started your book maybe a year ago or before. Whereas Susie says, well, why don't you start with the cover, the tagline, the idea, what the product you're selling is, and then match that to the market, and then write the product, then write the book, and do it that way around, start thinking. And then when you get into the writing, what are those key ingredients that we know readers want that makes them turn the page? It's it gets into a lot of detail. You will come away with pages of notes. The early feedback is people with works in progress that they are pivoting on and rewriting or going about making sure that they're getting it right. And even some quite experienced authors, Mark, I've noticed posting in that it's reinforced some of the things that they knew, but maybe they've drifted away from a little bit, which happens. So yes, it's the course has gone really well. You can read all about it at selfpublishingformula.com/bestseller. So this is going to go out this Friday. We're knocking $100 off the price, which is a third of the price, for for the opening period of days that this is being launched is a kind of, you know, get it going, get people into the Facebook group, etc. But it's a valuable course, and I think it's bottom priced anyway at $297, to be honest. So we are probably going to lift that, I think, on the Wednesday. So if you're listening to this on the Friday, let's make this nice and simple and say the 1st of May will be the date that the course goes full price. So if you want to buy...
I'm surprised you missed a trick there. You missed a big trick. May the 4th.
May the 4th. Yeah, I'm not doing that. It's not about... Star Wars is mentioned in this course, but only fleetingly. So we will go to full price on May the 1st, so midnight on the 30th of April. So go to selfpublishingformula.com/bestseller. That discount will be there until the 30th of April to get on board with that course. As I say, feedback from the early readers, early students is very, very positive indeed.
Did you say they were digging it?
They're digging it.
Welcome to the 70s with Hepcat, James Blatch, digging Hip the podcast
cat.
Today.
Hepcat. What's Hep- a Hepcat?
Hepcat. Look it up.
Okay. So you know more about the 70s than I do. Listen, I've never really left the 70s. It's the greatest decade. You didn't have quite so many pandemics in the 70s. I know you had Southeast Asia wars, but, you know, we didn't have these.
Yes.
Let's go back. Anyway, we're going back. The economy is going back to the 70s. The oil price is going back to the 70s.
Yes.
At the moment. Oh, God, my camera's shut down because it's too warm. It's okay. I'm recording on this screen as well. That's okay. Good. Okay, look, that's the bestseller course, and there's stuff to come in the future on that front. We'll, that I think is going to be a very useful and fun addition for the SPF array of courses. We put a lot of time and effort into this. I think it's been two years.
It's been a while.
Yeah, we've been putting this course together. It had an early iteration, and we went away again, went to beta, came back again, remodeled it, and it's out there now. So it's a very, very good product. Okay. Let's talk about the foundation. So the number of people who won't be in a position to pay for our courses, won't be in a position to pay for editing, won't be able to pay for covers, is going to go up as a result of this crisis. I think because the economy is going to slump down, particularly people at the beginning of their careers who are currently relying on paid jobs that might not be there in a few months. Without getting too doom and gloom about it, one of the things we've always done is we've run a foundation which picks out those talented authors, as people who just need that kickstart, that financial kickstart to get going. And that scheme delightfully has increased, as broadened, because a number of our existing students who've done well from your teaching, Mark, have said to us they want to give something back. It started with Mark Recklow, I think, was the first one who came to us and said he wanted to sponsor an extra place, and now we have quite a few more. So we're really broadening this scheme.
We do, yes. So Mark Recklow is sponsoring a non-fiction author. Lucy Score is doing romance writers. And Tony Moyles has also said that he would like to contribute. And Dawn Brooks is going to be sponsoring a cozy mystery spot next year. So that actually brings the total number of sponsorship places up to 8. And each of those, the people who are selected to win a scholarship from us. And also, so we're working with Reedsy and us. So we kind of put half of the money in, and then these other authors are chipping in $2,500 each, which is extremely generous of them. That means that they get the ads course 101, our kind of foundational course. We'll probably chuck in the bestseller course. We'll probably chuck in the covers course as well. So that's 4 courses from us, and $2,500 each. So that's pretty generous. And it's we've had people, as we mentioned last week, like Elle Thorpe, who took the course or was sponsored last time around or the time before, and is now doing really, really well. And she's not the only one who's done well through the foundation. So it's definitely worth applying. There are some requirements that you need to hit in order to be eligible, but you can find out all of those details at I think it's selfpublishingformula.com/foundation. But there's a link on the homepage up on the top bar on the right-hand side. You can check that out.
Yeah, if you just go to selfpublishingformula.com, as Mark says at the top of the page. Yeah, so a huge thank you to Emmanuel and Ricardo at Reedsy, reedsy.com. They've built a fantastic platform for finding editors and cover designers and all the rest of it, and have never hesitated in dipping into their pockets to help out on this particular scheme. They also put a bit of money behind the bar when we go and drink in various exotic locations around the world. They're great partners with us. So I want to say thank you to them. And to those authors coming forward and doing that. Brilliant. What a lovely community we have.
We do. Now, before I'm going to jump, because I know you've forgotten, but before we jump into the actual interview today, we also should mention Hello Books, which, as we mentioned, was it last week? I think it was last week we mentioned it for the first time. So this is a project that we're working on. It's kind of still in gestation at the moment in terms of exactly what it might look like, but it will be something along the lines of a BookBub model, a free Booksy, bargain Booksy type model, with a big mailing list and segmented into genres that readers have indicated that they want to find out about. Free books to start with, but discounted books as we build the list up. And we kind of put out, we mentioned it in the podcast, I posted in the Facebook group, and I think I sent an email out as well, just encouraging people to sign up to indicate that they're interested. And I think we've had about 2,500 authors who have said that they would like to be considered, or at least kept up to date as to what we plan when it comes to Hello Books, which we think will probably launch, I think, in about a month. Is probably what we're looking at. So we're in the process of building a website at the moment. We've got a designer, so it's going to be nicely branded, high quality, you know, hopefully as you'd expect from us. And yeah, I'm kind of thinking about it quite a lot at the moment on dog walks as to how this might actually look. But we want to get 1 million subscribers in the first year. That's the aim I have. We are going to be investing quite heavily in building a Facebook audience. You know, probably spending $4,000 or $5,000, $6,000 a month, something along those lines, to build the audience up and advertising the offers as we do new promotions. Maybe bi-monthly to start with, but eventually moving to a weekly basis, and then probably eventually moving to a daily basis as well. But we you know, kind of starting slowly. We will make mistakes. We probably don't know all the mistakes that we'll make until we make them. So we're just trying to kind of, I'm trying to keep my eyes on the ball to make sure that I anticipate the worst ones and we can avoid those. But it's a good start, I think. We're very encouraged with the response that we had.
Well, our very early aim is to give value to people who take part in the scheme. So if you put your book forward, you pay whatever it is, we haven't decided yet, probably it's going to be affordable, that's for sure, compared to quite a few of the other schemes out there, that you get value, that your book gets put in front of readers likely to be supporters and readers of yours. Our aim really for the first year, we're playing a long game with this, we should say, to people, this is a long game. We are going to get this right over a period of time and build up a reader list that's going to benefit authors in our community, and I'm sure that we're going to get there and with this, and hopefully hit the ground running. We're doing so much work in the background. 2,500 people on the wait list. You can join the wait list to be the first to hear. We are probably going to end up prioritizing those first few promotions, so you might want to get in early. If you go to hellobooks.com, and you'll find a waitlist page sitting there ready for you. In fact, soon we might, by the time this goes out, we might have our new branding on that waitlist page, because we've just got our designer who's, we've gone through the process of selecting. It's always fun selecting the logo, the colours, the font, all the rest
of it. Yes, it's very entertaining for people who haven't done this before. We have a Slack channel, which we have lots of Slack channels now, but there's one for Hello Books, and we've been posting. Or John, who's in charge of working with Sarah, who's the SPF designer. We've been working with her for 3 or 4 years now. She's designed a series of logos, and we started with 5 or 6 possibles, and we kind of argued amongst ourselves and narrowed it down to 2. And then Sarah works on those. We then picked one, and then the last few days we've been talking about various different shades of green and yellow and red and picking the color that we want and the fonts that we want. So it is. It's quite fun, and she's turned it around really quickly as well, which is great. So we're pleased with. I think we're pleased with how it will turn out.
Yeah, and bless Sarah. She's a very good designer, Sarah Cattle. We should give her a plug there. She's done some great work for us, and bless her. I think she was due to be in Japan on a family holiday at the moment, so that didn't work out for her. But hopefully,
she's
at some point.
You're wearing her work, James.
I am wearing her work. Yes, I am indeed. That's her work. So. Excellent. Who are you wearing, James? I'm wearing Sarah Cattle, I should say, when I go to the next awards group. Okay, look, we've got an interview today, which is, we talk a lot about success in this podcast and trying to achieve success and what you need to have in place for success. This podcast turns that on its head a little bit and addresses the question of what happens when the success you think you wanted doesn't turn out to be healthy for you. And this is an author called James Sumner, who has appeared on the podcast in the past. He was quite an early student of ours, walked up to us. I can remember very clearly the day he walked up to us at London Book Fair and introduced himself and said he couldn't wait for the course to be launched. And was an early success story for us. He quit his job, became a full-time author, had a big smile across his face. But things started falling apart for him, and he in part blames his success as an indie author for that, the situation he found himself in. So we're not shirking away from this subject, this interview. It's a very important part of everything that we do, is to think about the holistic, your mental health as much as anything else. So I'm not going to waffle on too much. I think James explains the story extremely well, and I think it's going to be a very useful interview for lots of us. So let's hear from James.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
James P. Sumner.
That's me.
Hey.
Hello.
Welcome back to the podcast. We first bumped into you, we're in what remains of London Book Fair. It's been cancelled.
Yeah,
it's in Olympia. But we bumped into you probably 3 years ago?
5 years ago.
Was it five? No,
it's our five-year anniversary, James. I'm hurt you don't remember.
Is it 5 years ago?
It is, yeah. Because I came to three and then I wasn't there last year. So now that I'm back, it's my fifth year down in London. And
wow.
Fifth year with you guys, yeah.
And you came up to us and we were in the early stages of SPF. And you said, I want to buy your course. When can you open your course?
Yeah, basically.
And you bought the course. And you got back to us straight away and you said, the course is amazing and you had success. And I'm going to cut a very long story short, but that's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Things didn't go to plan. Things caught up with you on the mental health side.
Yeah.
And you've had to make some changes in your life. And that's what we want to talk about in a very open and clear way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And part of the point of this interview is not just to hear your experience, but to encourage others to take a minute to think about their own mental health and to talk to people, particularly us men.
Yes.
Who are bad at it and have a high suicide rate, probably as a result of us not talking enough about how our mental health is. So let's talk to you about at what point things started to not be on the upward trajectory that they were when we first met.
Yeah, okay. As you say, it went really well for probably the first 18 months, 2 years of my writing career. I was able to go full-time June 2016.
What were you doing? What was your job?
I worked in the call centre. I was account manager, answering phones, but I was actually writing on the company dime, and I managed to get more books written on someone else's time than on my own, crazily. But I went full-time June 2016, and that was an immense milestone for me. It was very much a result of the success I found on the back of your course. But it was, it was a lot of hard work, and it was great. And I would say probably the first six, seven months was the honeymoon period. Every day I was in my pajamas, I'd go and make a coffee, go and lock myself in the room. Oh, it was amazing. It literally was a dream come true. It's what every author aims for. And then at that kind of 6-7 month mark, in hindsight, that was when it started to trail off a little bit. Not for the writing, not for the business side of things, but for my own mental health. So my personal circumstances kind of took over at that time. I was in an unhappy marriage, which has now ended. But I stayed in that situation for maybe 2.5 years of being incredibly unhappy and very sad. And the problem when you work from home and when your hobby is also your job, there's no escaping that.
Mm.
It's like, yeah, I used to have an argument with the ex-wife and then just go to work and forget about it for 8 hours. But when your work is the next room, there's no escaping it. And the world suddenly becomes very small. And when there's no escape and you don't admit there's a problem, that's when it starts to burn away. And over the course of 2 years, that's exactly what happened. It culminated originally in September 2018, when my wife essentially kicked me out. And that was a huge upset to my world. And writing at that point very got put on the back burner. I would say I've been away from the writing business probably for a good 12-18 months. I've not really done much with it. I've needed to take that time away, go on a sabbatical from it, and just focus on myself. And that was very difficult because writing was all I've ever wanted to do. It was what I would say was the only thing I was ever really truly good at, or I think it was. And it was difficult to be in a position where I actually blamed that for the circumstances I was in. Because the way I saw things, I was in this horrible, sad situation, and I was there because I was a full-time writer. So I kind of blamed that, and I almost started to resent the thing that I loved doing. which is a very strange situation to be in, because it's like, well, that's all I know. So if I don't want to do it anymore, now what? And I lost all sense of identity. I lost all sense of motivation. I couldn't get out of bed. I was depressed. I never sought help or treatment, but I was smart enough to know what was wrong with me. But I just kind of rolled with it, and that was that. From probably September 2018 through till September 2019, so that 12-month period, I kind of drifted, and I just kind of existed. And things got on top of me until September 2019, when I had a heart attack. Now, heart attacks are horrible. They're scary. They immediately, in the moment of clarity you have during the episode, you confront your own mortality. And I'm like, I was just thinking, God, I'm 37. This shouldn't be happening. And I was very fortunate. My sister-in-law was there at the time, and she got me to hospital. I was in hospital for about 6 hours. The doctor basically said, you're fine. That was a warning shot, right? I'm not going to tell you to cut out red meat or exercise more or anything like that. But whatever it is you're doing in life right now, stop it. Because that's the warning sign. You don't do it anymore.
So there was in your mind, there was a strong connection with your mental health state.
Absolutely.
And that physical heart attack.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the stress and the pressure that I was putting myself under took a physical toll. And that's the first time, as much as I've always been open about mental health awareness and my own mental health problems throughout the years, but I've never associated the mental problems with a physical problem. And it's like, actually, if you let it, it will put that much of a strain on your body that your body stops. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh God, now what do I do? So, and that was it. Within 30 days, I'd completely turned my life around. I'd chosen to go back to work. I'd gone and got a full-time job again, which is great.
So hang on, that's
Yeah,
no, it's brilliant. Summation, there's a few things I want to pick up. But
yeah,
I'm very interested in the plan that you made. And interestingly, one of the positive things you made, I can hear it in your voice, is that you positively decided to stop being a full-time writer, living at home, and you felt good about that.
I did, yeah.
Which is the opposite thing we say to almost everyone we ever speak to on this
podcast.
Exactly.
It's a very strange thing, because I would never discourage anyone from wanting to do it. I wanted to do it for as long as I can remember. But because of the mindset that's required to do that for a living, I don't think it's for everyone. I honestly don't. And if it is, and I know people who can just sit down and they just write for 12 hours straight and they're fine. It's like, that's great. I've proven I can't do that because I nearly killed myself trying. So I would never discourage anyone from doing it. But with things like this, what I want to do is just make people aware of there's more to it than you realise. It's not just about now your hobby's a business. It's not just about the mindset of having to run a company and focus on marketing and do all this. It's the mental aspect of it as well. It's like, I mean, every author knows the regular pitfalls is cat videos on Facebook that will stop you working. We all know that.
They are awesome though.
Yeah, they are awesome. If I could write a book about cat videos, I would be number one in the planet. There's procrastination, there's self-doubt. There's, lack of sort of struggling with concentration or writer's block, anything like that. They're the things that we know about. They're the things that authors are aware of, and there are multiple options to help deal with them. What people don't necessarily think or consider an issue at the time is things like an unsupportive partner or an unsupportive wife. Now, I don't imagine I'm in a unique position when I say that's one thing that happened to me, but if you're a writer and your world exists around introversion and your own space and that creative need to wake up at 3 a.m. and write down a way to kill someone, if the other person you're with
if
the person you're with doesn't do that, it's sometimes hard for them to understand. And it's like, why are you being miserable locking yourself in the spare room for 3 hours? And it's like, I'm not miserable, I'm just working. It's like me going to an office. Imagine me leaving the house, doing the commute and going to work. That's exactly what this is. I'm just at home. Now, in my situation, it was a case of, oh, well, you're at home, so therefore, here's a list of chores to do. And it's like, that's not how it works. But there was that fundamental lack of understanding which caused conflict. And as I alluded to before, when there is that conflict in your home environment, which is also your work environment, there's no escaping it. And it becomes very quickly something that's very hard to deal with. And people don't always think of that as something that could be a problem. And it's the same with introversion. Now, my first book fair, I remember seeing Joanna Penn speak, And something she said has stuck with me all this time, and it was, being an introvert doesn't mean you hate people or you don't like the outside world. It just means you find strength on your own. In the same way an extrovert will go to a party and they will come alive and be the, like Freddie Mercury was an extrovert. You put him in a room full of people and he's alive. Introversion is just the opposite of that. Put you in a room on your own and suddenly you, everything's firing and, you know, that's where you're happy. And it's like, that's all it is. And it's like, yeah, it is. But people don't always understand that. And being on your own for so long, sometimes it's like you forget what it's like to not be that way and you need to be able to turn it off. And if you don't, again, the world becomes a very small place and suddenly going outside becomes a problem. And outside is the escape. And suddenly there's no off switch. And then you're just kind of trapped in this cycle of your own life with no escape. And that all sounds very kind of drastic and doom and gloom, but that's exactly what happened to me. And I've realised now that I'm probably not the only one that's happened to. And I think the good thing about things like this is it's important to show that you're not alone if that's your situation. Yeah. And it's not a problem telling people. It's not a problem to talk about it.
Yeah,
I'm not ashamed to talk about the fact I struggle. I don't think anybody should be.
And that's brilliant. Although there is a point about, which I'm going to come back to, about how long it took you to address it, which is a very common thing. So we'll come back to that. But I think also about working from home is that even without the difficulties that you had with your marriage and unsupportive partner, when you quit, when you've been in a 9-to-5 and you quit that and you're working from home, people may very easily dream of that when they're 9-to-5 and see the positives, but actually don't realise that your 9-to-5 existence creates a framework that you exist in where other people take responsibilities for lots of parts of your day.
Yeah.
When you're on your own in your house, it's you alone, and that can bear down on people. You're responsible for every aspect of the career and business that's going to work, and you live with that. And the physical aspect of it, even without, like I say, a partner with things going wrong, is you don't change your environment at all for hours, days, weeks, months at a time. And I think I love it. I like working from home, but I built an office in my garden.
Yeah.
It was a really important thing for me to do. I actually could not have gone on working inside the house. It's a small thing. It's 6 yards away. But it might as well be down the road, you know, in London. It's those things, you do have to think about that.
Yeah, it's making that distinction. And that was the first thing. And again, hindsight's always 20/20, as they say. And those first 6 months when I left work and the next day, I pretty much did the entire Ads for Authors course. I just binge watched it like a Netflix special for like 18 hours straight. And that was it. And I worked, I would probably say for 2 years straight, I worked 12, 13, 14, 15 hours a day. I wouldn't do that for anybody else. And I justified it by saying, yeah, but this is mine. This is like, if it's do or die. You know, if I don't make this work, I don't pay the bills. And that fear kind of kept me going. But at the same time, you don't need to work 18 hours a day to make that happen.
You were a terrible boss of you.
I was a horrible, my boss was horrible.
Yeah.
He always made me work. I couldn't take a dinner break. I got to walk the dog, that was about it. But I got to the point where I was arguing with the dog and that was my only conversation.
Yeah.
And when it answers back, you know you're in trouble.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, let's talk about a very important part of this is how long you went with deteriorating mental health with your level of awareness, what was going on, and still really didn't do anything about it, which is a long time. Then you have a heart attack, and it's that old thing. You wouldn't leave a physical ailment untreated. Most people wouldn't.
No.
But we do leave creeping amounts of crippling mental health untreated. Don't even speak to our mates about it. To a point where it becomes a crisis.
Yeah.
What, you know, I mean, and like I say, you're aware of this.
I am, painfully aware, and to the point where I'm almost embarrassed by the fact I let it get as bad as it did. Because...
Well, you shouldn't be embarrassed, because I think it's a very common thing.
But... Yeah, well, that's it, it is. And it's a real shame, because you pull it perfectly. You know, if you broke your arm, you won't just let it heal on its own. You'll be walking around like this for the rest of your life. And it's the same with your mind. If you try and let it heal on its own, it's going to heal crooked. You need to take the time. Now, I spent probably 18 months very unhappy, trapped in the marriage, and then I spent a year drifting along after it ended. So that's 2.5 years in total of me being very, very sad, very depressed, very unhappy. And I knew how unhappy I was, but it's that fear of change. It's taking the step to make a change. And people say it about victims of domestic abuse, male and female victims. It's like, well, just leave. It's like, yeah, but I can't, because that's all I know. It's a safe environment, even though it's an unhealthy environment, it's safe because it's what you know. And it's very difficult to make a change on that scale, especially, the last 12 months, especially when it's been just me, I've not actually been single on my own since I was like 18. So I don't know what to do with myself. It's weird. You know, and...
Well, video games, surely.
Well, video games to a point, yeah. And that leads back to the procrastination a little bit. But
the did you think you weren't making changes because you feared it would make things worse?
Yeah. It's because I didn't know what changes to make. I didn't know where to start. If as a person, I had no identity. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what anything about myself outside of writing. And I'd put writing on the shelf for now. So it was like, there was nothing left. It was a blank canvas. So I'm like, well, I don't know what to do. So I just drifted. I just let things happen. And things just got worse because I don't know, I was in denial, I suppose. So it took me 2.5 years and a heart attack to make me think, okay, next steps, let's think about this properly now. I need to make a change. I'm nearly 40. I've not got that many more do-overs in life when it comes to things that you need to, targets you need to set for yourself. So I had to sit down. And my sister-in-law is awesome. She made me do it. She sat me down with a brew when I got home from the hospital. And she said, here's a pen and paper, bullet point the rest of your life right now because you need to make changes. And it's like, that's a good point.
I was going to ask you how you went about it, the process. I wondered if there was a list at some point.
No, it was literally not a massive list, but there was like 3 or 4 bullet points on there. And it was just like, what do I enjoy? What do I want to do? What do I want to get out of it? And that was the mindset. It was like, this is what I need to think about doing. And the first thing was go back to work.
So the steps you took, go back to work. So basically not to rely on writing as a career.
Yeah.
You probably don't want to stop writing.
No, and I've not stopped writing. And to be honest, going back to work has allowed me to fine tune my approach. So now I'm not particularly following any trends. I'm not looking really what other authors do. I'm just doing it for myself. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, I'll try something else. But the freedom of not having the pressure. And this, I remember this is something Mark said to me very early on when I first met you guys. He said, you don't do it until you're ready. I remember Mark said like he was going to give himself 12 months of making what he made full time before he could trust it. Obviously he, but that's a very good benchmark. I was kind of thrown into it because I was fired from my full time job at the time, but I made it work and it was great. But the pressure, the financial pressure is a lot to handle, especially when you're doing everything yourself. As soon as you take that pressure out, but you're still doing something you enjoy doing, I love my full-time job, and I never thought I would say that. But I enjoy it because I'm not there for the money. I'm there to essentially get me out of the house and be sociable. But having that environment to go to, and then still being able to come home and, in my spare time, as a hobby, now focus on the writing in a structured way with no pressure. It doesn't have to work to... for me to eat or pay the electricity bill. That's quite liberating. And it's brought the fun, the love of it back, which I've missed greatly.
Yeah. So this is not so much a recipe for what you need to do to be happy. And it's being aware of what you are going to be comfortable with and enjoy. And working on your own as an author, despite it being the dream a lot of people think they have or have, might not be for everybody.
Yeah, I don't think it probably isn't for everyone because there's going to be people who, there are going to be extroverts who are writers, but they're going to have a physical kind of medical need to be around people. So you're going to have to adjust the approach to it. But I would say it's perhaps not for everyone, but that doesn't mean it's not something you can pursue. And this is something I've discovered because a lot of people who are full-time writers aren't just writers. Mark is a prime example, Adam Croft, Joanna Penn, they have side hustles, they have other things that you do besides writing that are linked to it. So writing as a craft doesn't have to be the fundamental nuts and bolts of what you do. You can do other things that relate to it and you're still making a living from it. And for me, doing that required me to go back to full-time work. And I got a full-time job as a digital marketer. I'm now a digital marketing executive. And I don't mind saying I got that job purely on the strength of having done the self-publishing formula course. Because like what?
So there's a kickback in it for us.
There's possibly some commission. Yeah, you're
10% of the salary. I think we said, didn't we? Yeah,
you're getting my valuable time.
We are. We love that. No, that's actually brilliant. And we do occasionally people talk to us about the course, saying I'm in a completely unrelated industry. Is there anything in this for me? And we usually say no. It's specific to books, but I think there is.
I think you understand digital marketing for one product, you can do it anywhere else. Anyway, that's a side issue. You mentioned your sister-in-law.
Yeah.
An important conversation you had, and fantastic of her to sit down and sort of and focus you on that recovery plan. But during that 2.5 years, the period in the unhappy marriage and the period by yourself, were there not mates around, other people you spoke to? And
no, there wasn't. And this was the annoying thing, because not wanting to get too much into the boring personal side of things, but when I got married and I moved away to where she was, I burnt a lot of personal bridges to do so, because they all said, she's a psycho, don't go with her.
And just for legal reasons, she may or may not be.
I'm not naming her, but yeah. But I didn't listen, and I burnt a lot of bridges. So when I left, my entire life for my entire time was there. So when I moved away from that, there was nothing from my old life there. So I spent a fair amount of time on my own, and I needed a bit of time on my own. But I've since spent time rebuilding a lot of bridges that thankfully have become stronger than they ever used to be, which is great. And I now have a network of friends to talk to. And what I've noticed sort of 10 years on, like my group of friends, you know, you just go and sit in the pub and drink and tell bad jokes and things. But now everyone's older, they've got married and had kids and stuff. And when you sit down and you have a heart to heart and you say, look, do you know what? I'm having a really bad day today. I need a brew. It's like, yeah, of course, come round. And you can just sit and talk. And I think it's important to have people around you. There are people around you who can take you out and get you drunk and have fun with. But you need people who can sit down and you can trust to say, do you know what? I'm having a really bad day. This made me upset yesterday. I'm struggling with this. Can you help? That's important to have. And I'm very fortunate to have a handful of people that I can rely on for that. And they can rely on me for it, because there's that level of understanding in that respect. And that's really helped me sort of in this stage of my life and the next stage.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think it's when things are on top of you, and everyone, as you get older, life does get more complex for people, and you have low moments. And I think sometimes you think, I don't know where to go. And you have a long conversation with a good friend who has exactly that. And even though they don't have the answers for you, the solution, the therapeutic value of sharing and having that conversation, having some sympathy, cannot be underestimated.
Well, that's it. And sometimes you just need to talk it out. It's almost like you're having a debate with yourself. I mean, the amount of times I would literally sit, and even from a writing point of view, I would sit on my own in a room and I'd be having an out loud conversation with myself. Like, how can I kill that guy and make this? And it sometimes helps. It's sometimes easier. And that isn't just for writing. Mm. You know, I'm not encouraging people to actively start talking to themselves, but talking out loud to someone, anyone who's willing to listen, it helps you just find your own solutions sometimes. And it's that mental release, you know. I always compare it to if you're cooking and you've got a pan on the stove, and if you put the lid on, it'll start to froth and boil over and it'll all go wrong. Sometimes you just got to take the lid off and let a bit of the steam out.
Yeah.
That's all it is. You just got to look after yourself. That's the important part. And not be afraid to say that you need to look after yourself as well.
And is it your experience that generally women are probably better at this? Is that a myth than men at talking to each other about stuff?
Do you know what? That's a tricky one, because I suppose you don't want to say the male and female divide. There shouldn't be a difference. But the fact is, women are more comfortable talking to their friends and their peers and other women about their problems. Whereas typically, if you sit two men down in a room and one of them says, God, I'm feeling really sad today, they're like, oh, man up, have a shot. And it's like, no, don't ever say man up to me. That's not how it works. And thankfully, I think more and more men are getting comfortable, are realising it's okay to talk about stuff like that. And yeah, it is a predominantly male issue. I think men throughout the years have had sort of peer pressure, battles with ego and things. It's like, there's nothing wrong with it. I don't feel like I'm any less of a man because I'm telling you I've had mental health issues. I think it takes more strength to admit those problems than it does to hide them. And I know Tyson Fury has a recent done interview, and that's gained a lot of attention because of how brutally honest he is about his own struggles. And it's like, you tell that guy that he's being a big wuss because he's talking about mental health.
I'm not going to.
Exactly. And I'm almost as tall.
Tyson Fury is a very aggressive boxer.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and even someone in his profession has had the issues, has had the battles, and he's come out the other side and he's talking about them. And good for him.
Yeah, and the statistics aren't great for male suicide.
No.
Rates are,
no,
they're are traditionally
not.
Higher, have always been higher.
Yeah.
There's several campaigns on in the UK at the moment. I'm not sure what it's like in the US and Canada and Australia, but in the UK there is a kind of Take a Minute campaign, which they're using soccer, football in the UK at, and there, I think a few weeks ago every game was delayed by 1 minute as a symbolic minute for men to talk to each other and stuff. Right. So you must feel heartened that this is a conversation that's happening now.
Yeah, I am. I think it's great. And I know Prince William has done a lot for it, and probably Prince Harry as well, over the sort of the last kind of 5 or 6 years to make it okay and to raise more awareness. And it's taken this on, but people are finally catching on. Like you say, the extra minute for in front of a football match, it's like, that's a prime example, because football is predominantly a male-orientated sport. So putting it in that kind of environment, they're thinking, God, if all them footballers are doing it, maybe it's all right for me to do it. You know, and it's like, that's what we need. And yeah, I think it's brilliant. And I still don't think there are enough people doing it. I think in an ideal world, there shouldn't be any taboo subjects like that. There shouldn't be any fear of talking about what's wrong. I've got no problem talking about it. And I'm, believe it or not, I'm quite a shy guy. I'm a closed book to a lot of people. But when it comes to something like this, it's important. And I have no shame in what I've been through. And I'd rather talk about it openly to you. It sounds cliched, but if one person watching this sees it, it clicks and they avoid the pitfalls I've been through, then job done. Do you know what I mean? That'd be amazing.
Did you seek professional medical help for your mental health issues that you saw at the time?
No, I didn't. I have done in the past when I was younger. I didn't this time, and I'm not entirely sure why. I think it was because, again, not wanting to get into it too much, but my ex-wife was a therapist. It was her job to help people, and yet she was putting me through what she put me through, and it's like, I don't understand that. It was very foreign. And I think, I don't know, maybe subconsciously that put me off going seeing professional help. It was like, well, that's what the professionals are doing. But no, I foolishly...
Tainted a bit for you.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of ruined it a little bit. And yeah, foolishly, I tried to do it all on my own.
A very strong thing for the people to do, and can be very helpful.
No, absolutely it is. And I'm certainly not knocking going seeing a therapist, I think. And it goes back to talking about it. And I know that as a therapist, it's not necessarily their job to tell you the answer. It's their job to help you find it yourself. And sometimes that's just a case of them sitting down, giving you a brew and letting you talk for an hour. And more often than not, you'll come to the realization yourself, and they're just there to sort of help you through it. And you need that. And a friend can do that just as well as a therapist. But it's important to have somebody. It's not... I would never recommend trying to do it on your own, because I don't think anyone can be that strong to pull themselves out and analyse it and sort of look on it, on the outside looking in. You can't separate yourself from the situation you're in. You need someone to sort of say, hang on a minute. Now, I had a doctor, that worked fine, but I don't recommend waiting to that stage. You know, go and see a friend, go and just have a coffee, turn your laptop off, put your phone on silent, go and talk about your books, go and do whatever you want, but just get out of your environment. Just go and see someone and have a chat. That's all it takes. A little bit every day. Prevention is better than cure. Yeah. That's what my mother always used to say.
Very, very good advice. So it was 6 months ago that you wrote that list. I guess September 2019.
Yeah, God, yeah, it's approaching 6 months, yeah.
And how's it been? How's it feel to you now, the decisions you made?
Quite honestly, and I say this with no fear of tempting fate, I can honestly say I'm the happiest I've ever been. And I don't say that saying that, oh, you know, tempting fate, it's all going to go wrong. It's not. I've worked bloody hard to get where I am. I'm reaping the rewards, finally. I literally couldn't be happier. I love my job. I'm really good at it. My first day, they asked me what click-through rate was, and I answered, and they were like, oh my God, he knows what
click-through
is. I'm telling you now, me and Mark. You know, I love my job. It's opening up a lot of doors for me, for my own work. And this is what I alluded to as well. You don't necessarily have to stray too far from writing, or if you are a full-time writer, there are other things you can do. I do freelance work where I assess social media posts for a company. I'm not allowed to name, but they're a big social media platform, you do the math. But I assess social media posts, assess the integrity of them and how well they're targeted. Now, it kills a couple of hours a day, it's not particularly taxing, but with the author hat on, I'm seeing what all the other Facebook ads in the world are doing, and I can take notes. So it's related. It's a bit of extra cash in the pocket, but it's related to what I do. I'm a full-time digital marketer. There's a lot that I can take away from work that helps me with my own thing, and that's great. So it's all related, but there's no pressure. And I actually enjoy it all. And I work around a great bunch of people. I'm not there for the money, which is great. I come home, I get a couple of hours to work on my books, do my own thing. I've got time to relax, I've got my own space.
Can play video games without feeling guilty, which is another thing about working for yourself at home, is that almost any leisure time you take, you have this nagging guilt thing in your ear.
There's something more I could be doing, and it's like, isn't.
It's really important to get over that and actually just have, and if you want to switch off a day or 2 days, whatever, do that. It's a very important thing.
I used to, sort of in the first 12 months when I was trying to find my own routine, I'd take myself off to the driving range for a couple of hours, just 50 balls, set of clubs, and I'd go back and do another 5 or 6 hour stint. And that did work for me for a while. I did quite like that. And I do miss that now being full time, but they tend to frown on it if you just do one middle of the afternoon. Just go to the cinema. Yeah. There were ways to do it to manage your day. But don't forget that it is a job. And I think sometimes when you make the transition from something you do for fun, making that your living, it's an adjustment that not everyone realizes they need to make.
Yeah.
And you suddenly need to stop doing that in your spare time and do it 9 to 5 or whatever hours you work, but have a cut-off point.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize I can remember when I first quit, which is 2013, I was amazed at how much you get done when you work from home by yourself, because there's no commuting. You can even get up quite late and you'll be working much sooner and quicker than you would have been when you got up early and went into London or whatever. And actually by 11, 12 o'clock in there, you can get loads done. You need to understand that. You don't need to necessarily even put in 8 hours a day to achieve a good work rate at stuff. But we try to kill ourselves usually when we start off because of that crushing doubt. And what are you doing? Are there any specific steps you're taking to ensure you're going to carry on an even trajectory or upward trajectory mental health-wise?
I'm making sure I keep enjoying it. I think that's the main thing. It's like I make sure nothing changes that I don't want to change. If I feel something slipping away, I know enough now, again, hindsight being what it is, I know enough now to spot the signs and nip it in the bud. There was a period, it was only a couple of weeks ago, I've been doing a lot around going through my old books and just reformatting them, and I've got Vellum finally. I've seen the light.
Isn't it lovely?
It is amazing. And I've been going through, but typically as a writer, if you go through your old books to change the formatting, you're going to re-edit them all.
Of course.
That's inevitable. And I've been doing that, and I was doing that for a couple of weeks, and then I suddenly found I wasn't shutting off at night. And it'd be like 1 in the morning, I was like, just got to finish this page. I've got to finish this page because I'm limited with my time in the evening. And I was like, I'm up at 6 to go to work. Stop. And I did that for about 2 days, and I went, hang on a minute, I'm starting to feel burnt out here. So I stopped, and I took 2 days, I got on from work and did nothing. And then I went back to it, and I went back steadily, and I went back to doing a couple of hours and then taking my own time. I was like, right, there we go, strayed from the path a little bit, but I spotted it and we're back now, and it was fine. And it's just things like that, and it's just not getting complacent, because as nice as life is now, as happy as I am, as fun as things are, it's still work. It's still hard work to maintain everything, because it's so easy to just let things go, to think, oh, I'm all right now, so I don't need to worry about it. Well, you do, because the moment you stop worrying about it is when things start to overwhelm you again. You need to keep on top of it, but that doesn't have to be a chore. It's just a case of changing your mindset a little bit, just changing your outlook on things, realizing it's okay to take a couple of hours for yourself. Just little things like that. Little things make a big difference, especially when it comes to mental health.
James, it's fantastic talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks. It's been good.
Well, thank you so much for being so open and so educational about it as well. I thought maybe a slightly boring word about it, but because we don't talk about this stuff enough.
This is it. And like I say, I have no problem talking about what I've been through, because there's no reason it can't be seen as a positive thing. It's ended up being positive for me. So it's good to hopefully to show people that there were ways to cope with it, there were ways to deal with it, and there's light at the end of the tunnel, because that's not always the thing that people realise. There is a way out. We'll be fine.
And I'm so happy for you that you quit the author lifestyle and got a 9 to 5.
Exactly,
because it's the dream at the moment, isn't it?
It's weird, you know, like 3.5 years of being my own boss. When I went for the interview, the guy who interviewed me ended up being my boss, and he's like, I've got to ask, how are you going to find the transition going back to working for someone else? And I'm like, don't worry about it. Just don't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
We'll be all right.
Yeah.
But no, it's been great. It's been literally the best thing I ever did. Very happy.
Fantastic.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Okay, there you go. James Sun, what a brilliant interview and a brilliant guy. And I think it's worth reiterating that he is a much, much happier person than clearly he was. As you heard from the interview, he had very low points in his life. Things got very desperate for him indeed. He's now back in full-time work, where he has mates at work and goes to, you know, goes for a drink after work or cup of tea, as he talks about a lot. And he still writes in the evening. He hasn't given up his dream of being a writer. And it might be in the long run that James does end up quitting his 9-to-5 again and working full-time as a writer. But it's about adjusting your life and not necessarily thinking, well, that's my definition of success, without taking a step back and thinking, is that my definition of success? Is that what I want? And it obviously went a bit too far in James's case before he asked those big questions of himself.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has to consider what they want out of life, really, and which career is going to enable you to get what you want. So on the one hand, you know, I'm very happy with what I've built, you know, the writing and then SPF, and, you know, maybe we have another business with Hello Books as well in the long term. I'm happy with that. I feel the kind of work-life balance is pretty good for me. I don't work very long hours, you know, 9-till-5. That's kind of the maximum for me. I don't work weekends. So that's fine. But it is, I do remember in the early days, it's when you kind of feel that you have an opening and you've got to work really hard to take advantage of that. Actually, going back a little further than that, I remember when I was originally published by Macmillan in 2000, 1999, 2000, I remember having an agent interested in a short story that I'd written, and then saying, I'd basically lied and told them that it was an extract from a novel, and they asked me for the full novel, and I had to make a series of excuses whilst I went back and wrote a novel in 6 weeks, which was, for me, was, I was a lawyer at the time, so working long hours in London and then getting home at 7 or 8 and then working till 2 or 3 in the morning to get the words in. And at the end of that, I don't get sick very often, but I was just exhausted. I couldn't get out of bed. And it's kind of not physical exhaustion, just mental exhaustion. I just completely drained myself. And I haven't had that since, but I think it is something that you can you can fall prey to, especially if it feels like the prize you've always wanted is tantalizingly within grasp. And, you know, maybe you want to finish a novel, to finish a trilogy, because you think that's what you need to go full time. Or if you are full time as a writer, maybe you want to make 10,000 a month or 15,000 a month, and you feel you're close, and maybe you feel that if you don't hurry, then the audience will move on and forget about you. And it's quite easy to forget about the fact that if you don't look after yourself, everything else is irrelevant. You can't write if you're sick. So yeah, it's a good interview. I heard James talk to Adam Croft about that on his podcast, and I thought we should get him on, because, you know, it's to bring it to our audience would be a valuable thing to do. So I hope people got plenty out of that.
Yeah, and another aspect of this to think about that James discovered is that working in isolation wasn't for him. And it isn't for everybody. It seems like a dream. It sort of suits me, because I don't like other human beings. But social people like James, who enjoy the company of other people. No, I'm being jovial, but it doesn't suit everyone. Motivating yourself during the day, being for fairly long periods by yourself, and being close to your family, but them not really understanding what it is you do, which is certainly the case. They might have no idea what happens in my office. It's not for everyone. And sometimes you know, other people thrive in an environment where there's people around them all the time and everything's shared a little bit. So now there's ways around that, possibly. I mean, this current pandemic has brought Zoom.us to everyone's attention. Suddenly all my neighbors are using this product that we've been using for years.
Which we're using now.
And using now, and realize, you know, people are realizing that actually you can do this quite, you can open a beer in the evening and get a couple of friends on for a chat. And actually, if you're working by yourself and you've got author friends, rather than meet up at conferences and just exchange emails in between, why don't you once or twice a month get a little Zoom chat going and just pass the time of day for an hour? That's the sort of thing that's, I think, a healthy thing to do for us. So well done, James, I think, first of all, because it's quite brave talking about your mental health, talking about breakdowns, talking about recovery and all the rest of it. It's an important conversation that we have, conversations that are more common today than they certainly were when I was younger. Probably the same for you as well, Mark. You're not that much younger than me. So, yeah, a little bit younger.
Well, they wouldn't look at me at the moment. It doesn't look that way.
No, you look
I've gone full Robinson Crusoe at the moment.
knocking on 60 if you're watching on YouTube. Yeah, I'm looking forward to your 50th. That must be coming up soon.
F off. It's 4 years yet, Grandad.
You're the same age as my wife.
Big that's a bit odd. Year. I was just looking out the window and there's a great big brush just started brushing my window. Right. So the window cleaners have come round. So
he's socially distancing himself. Our window cleaner's not cleaning windows.
He's very far away, yes.
Good. Okay, look, excellent. That's it for today. Quite a busy episode. Just to remind you that our bestseller course, do not miss that discount. We will not be retrospectively applying. It's $100 off the full price of $297. So you get it for $197 and equivalent for the payment plan, which goes over 12 months to make it very affordable indeed. If you go to selfpublishingformula.com/bestseller, you need to do that by midnight on April the 30th. Which midnight in the world? The last midnight in the world, I always say. So midnight on April the 30th. I think it's Easter Island. Think is the last midnight in the world. Do you think we've got a big audience in Easter Island? Right, I think the rural broadband has just frozen again, which is just in time for me to say a goodbye by myself. So I have to do it for Mark. I have to say it's a goodbye from me and it's a goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with The Self-Publishing Show.